This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Have you made up your mind and are raring to vote, or perhaps still weighing your options, or maybe you'd prefer not to? Whatever the case, Election Day is getting very close, and with big and in many cases tight races up and down the ticket here in New Hampshire, much is at stake. Give us a call. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome. Our guests this week are Dan Barrick, Senior Policy and Politics Editor, NHPR, Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Why don't we start at the top of the ticket, the presidential race? Donald Trump's here today. Hillary Clinton's coming over the weekend. Looking back to the primary, this state was telling. It was where Trump got his first win, and it was where it first became clear that Hillary Clinton might not have an easy go galvanizing Democrats. Polls show New Hampshire, which has voted Democrat 5 of the last 6 presidential races, plenty tight. The campaigns are acting like it. Allie, you've been out there among the voters. What do you see the mood as far as the presidential race goes, and what are you seeing as this race careens to a close?
Sure. So speaking to voters, I think a lot of them are fatigued and angry and ready for this whole thing to be over. I went canvassing this past weekend, and, you know, a lot of voters are just confused was the most common thing that I heard. They don't really like either of their choices. I think some Republicans are turned off by Donald Trump, given some of his more controversial comments about certain ethnic groups and women. But at the same time, you know, they don't want to go over to Clinton, who many see as, you know, not being very trustworthy or truthful. And at the same time, I think some Democrats, Bernie here won by huge margins. And I think there still are some Bernie supporters who are really reluctant to move over to Hillary Clinton. I talked to a few this week who plan to either write in Bernie Sanders or who will vote for a third-party candidate like Jill Stein of the Green Party. So, you know, I think we're seeing the candidates coming here really trying to get people excited about going to the polls on Tuesday. And, you know, a lot of voters, at least that I have spoken to, seem still confused, not sure what they're going to do.
Obviously, Donald Trump is here today. He's going to be here on Election Eve. That seems to be an acknowledgement from him that New Hampshire is a must win. And, you know, the attention from Democrats, President Obama is coming, from Democrats that maybe Trump could win here. Do you see it that way, Dean?
You know, it's interesting. As you mentioned just a moment ago, New Hampshire's voted Democratic in 5 of the last 6 presidential elections. Pretty much for the entire cycle, New Hampshire has been in the lean Democratic category for Hillary Clinton. You know, that seems to perhaps be changing over the last week or two. You know, WMUR had the poll come out on Halloween that had her up, still had her up 7 points, but we've now seen these 2 other polls from WBUR and also Suffolk that have it basically as a dead heat. So, you know, maybe if you split the difference, it's a 2-3-4 point race. But, you know, the amount of attention being focused on the state, given that it's 4 electoral votes, is quite remarkable and suggests that both campaigns are probably seeing something that is leading them to believe that this state is winnable either way. So it's not something we've really had to confront in terms of analysis for most of this campaign because it's been sort of reliably leaning Democratic. But, you know, my guess is if Trump ends up doing well here on election night, that's going to signal some more significant problems for Hillary Clinton around the country. I mean, we'd be sort of a leading indicator on that, given that we've been leaning Democratic. To have him suddenly surge is going to signal that her campaign is in trouble elsewhere.
So, Dan, you've been looking at these polls. Are there any issues, beyond the kind of anxiety and distaste that voters may feel for both of these candidates that are informing this closeness, assuming the polls are correct?
Well, I mean, you see some degree of this at the end of any election where it tightens up a little bit. But I think in terms of just even beyond the polls, from a voter's point of view, this election, for New Hampshire voters at least, is really ending the way it began, which is just intense pressure from the candidates and the campaigns themselves. You mentioned Trump here today and Monday. Clinton campaign announced late last night that Hillary Clinton will be here on Sunday. President Obama will be here on Monday campaigning for Hillary Clinton. And I think one of the things that's going to be interesting beyond just, as Dean and Ali pointed out, how the four electoral votes for New Hampshire will swing with both campaigns obviously campaigning hard for it. And I know we'll get into this later during the show, is just what the down ballot implications will be for this final burst of campaigning and the dynamics between both parties' candidates down the ballot, Maggie Hassan and Ayotte at Senate, Sununu and Van Ostrom for governor. Both sides have had very different ways of navigating and negotiating with their respective presidential candidates. And that's really going to be on full display, I think, over the next 3 days.
Well, it strikes me that this final burst, you know, holds the potential to really, you know, determine the results, you know, that and, you know, the campaign's so-called ground game, how they drive supporters to the polls. And, you know, during the primary where Donald Trump did win big here, his ground game was doubted, you know, with some reason. It obviously worked out for him. Democrats will tell you they're quite organized historically, you know, really since, you know, the kind of golden age of Karl Rove. Democrats here have had the better ground game. You know, it can mean a lot in a tight race. And, you know, Ali mentioned the potential influence of third-party candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. And, you know, New Hampshire was seen as a place where those folks could really have an effect. New Hampshire is also where Gary Johnson had his now infamous Aleppo moment. And, you know, his vice presidential nominee, Bill Weld, is basically telling people to vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, do you see any signs out there, any of you, that Gary Johnson is going to pull any votes that could tip this?
Not in New Hampshire. I think he's doing a little bit better in the Southwest, where he's better known as a former governor. But, you know, here, you know, part of the conventional wisdom is that over time, as you get closer to Election Day, people sort of return to their parties and they sort of finish flirting with these other third party candidates. And, you know, I think Johnson, in some respects, has been his own worst enemy. And as you mentioned, Bill Weld is on a number of occasions has been almost sort of an odd booster for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, some people have said if that ticket had been switched and Weld had been on top, it might have drawn in more votes. You know, and then also Jill Stein, who's kind of been capped at about 2, maybe 3%, really picking up kind of only the most sort of disaffected Bernie Sanders voter. So, you know, I don't think, you know, I mean, certainly if combined they pick up, you know, 8 or 9 or 10% of the vote, well, that's significant. But I don't sense any sort of groundswell for them as an alternative to either of these two. I think, in fact, you're seeing the reverse. I just saw something that said that about, I think, 80% of Republicans are behind Trump, similar number behind Clinton. So, you know, both parties are consolidating, and it's going to come down to turnout. And, you know, the other thing is that Trump has, as you mentioned, for the primaries, it's also been the case in the general election that Trump has kind of, you know, sort of said that, you know, ground game isn't, you know, that he can do this differently without the kind of traditional organization that campaigns need. And he has relied on the RNC to some extent. But I think his belief is that through social media and through these rallies and kind of, you know, word of mouth and momentum, that's how he's going to drive people to the polls.
All right. Democrats will say that, you know, they look back and will say, you know, remember Ralph Nader in 2000? Obviously, he got 22,000 votes here. And, you know, Bush beat Gore by, I think, around 7,200. Mm-hmm. I was at a Democratic Get Out the Vote rally where that point was made with a good deal of authority. Why don't we go to the phones? Roger is on the line from Manchester. Go ahead, Roger.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I am a Hillary supporter, and I just don't understand why people say that she's untrustworthy when I think Mr. Trump lies at least 10 or 20 times more often. And I think his campaign is pure fantasy. I mean, he promises all kinds of things. I don't see any way he can do everything he says he's going to do. And the other thing is, I think Mr. Trump has a big advantage in that we don't have any of his emails. We don't have WikiLeaks coming out, you know, against him. And we don't even know if the WikiLeaks is doctored or if it's true. And so I hope that Hillary wins. That's all.
I mean, do any of the revelations on WikiLeaks or some of the other issues longstanding about Secretary Clinton's lack of transparency on certain things, does that give you pause or not?
No, it doesn't, because I think if we had revealed everybody's on both sides emails and stuff, I think we'd be pretty discouraged. I think everybody does so-called political things. I don't see anything that she does as being vitriolic or mean, or I think it's just the, as they say, making the sausage on what you're going to do.
All right.
I think Republicans do the same exact thing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Roger. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. We're working our way down the ballot in preparation for Tuesday's election day. Right now, we're talking about the top of the ticket. You know, Roger says, you know, he sees that some of these Clinton revelations is making the sausage. And that's a case that has been made, is that, you know, some of these revelations have been just kind of like laying bare the reality of how politics works. Do you think, you know, voters are seeing it that way, Dan?
Well, I think some are. I mean, Roger lays out a case that Clinton partisans and supporters make. But I do think one thing, it plays into a narrative around the Clintons that existed before these leaks around the Clinton Foundation and what some have described as the blurry boundaries between Secretary Clinton's work with the State Department and her husband's work with the foundation and her use of an email server. Just this general sense that it stretches back to Bill Clinton's presidency about redefining rules as they go along. Similar with Donald Trump. I mean, no, he's not been subject to the kind of WikiLeaks drip, drip, drip as Secretary Clinton has. But there's been a number of reported pieces on his tax returns, on the operations of the Trump Foundation that have similarly played into notions of his claims about his charitable giving that according to reports are not true. One thing that's just so unique about this campaign is this, where you have this unpredictable outside, constant leaking of information that can reshift the campaign narrative in an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big difference here is technology and the advent of email and the ability to get all of this kind of internal sausage making, if you will, exposed very quickly. As someone who has done a lot of research over the years at presidential archives, you go back to some older presidents, Eisenhower, I've studied LBJ, others, and you get into their personal papers, their diaries, their reflections, a lot of the same kind of stuff. You just don't have access to it because it can't be hacked at from the outside. So I think for the Clinton folks, it is unfortunate that they have sort of become the test case for the impact of technology on campaigns. I mean, I'm sure Republicans would say that's actually a good thing, but I think from their perspective, it's unfortunate. I wouldn't be surprised if this is going to sort of change how people do business in the future in terms of government. And, you know, there even been over the year, or, you know, in recent years, the last decade or two, there's been a lot of discussion about how to archive emails in the White House central files. So it's sort of a new frontier, and they're kind of paying a little bit of a price for it.
There have always been John Podestas in this world.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phone, and Barry is in Bedford. Good morning, Barry. Go right ahead. Barry, are you there? Okay. Well, how about we go to Celeste in Pembroke?
Yes. I just want to say that in considering both of the contestants, I have a total agreement with the last man that called in. Hillary Clinton may have her faults, but she does come on appearing to be civil, and you cannot say that. That whatever that person is that's opposing her, it is just a terrible comment on our whole country that man could run for president.
All right, Celeste, loud and clear. That man, Celeste, is not impressed by Donald Trump and his lack of civility. I mean, it is interesting, talking to voters. I've covered a few elections, but I can't recall one where there have been such, Democrats who disagreed with Mitt Romney, didn't get that angry. And Republicans that don't like President Obama rarely get that angry. What's that going to mean afterwards? And what's that going to mean Tuesday?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And that's, I think, the question that we, at least in the media, and I think a lot of the country has yet to really grapple with, is what Wednesday is going to look like. Because you have, anybody who goes to a Trump rally will encounter no end of people who are not only convinced that he's going to win, who dismiss polls that have consistently shown him trailing, but that describe kind of dire, apocalyptic terms, the dangers that a Hillary Clinton presidency poses. And Clinton supporters feel the same way. And you're right, the level of intense fear, really, of what a victory for the other side will mean is not, you did not see that in Obama-Romney or Obama-McCain or even a Bush-Kerry race.
And I think what part of that is, too, what we were talking about, you know, the drip of WikiLeaks and videos being released. I've talked to voters who feel like most of this election and a lot of the reporting has been focused on, you know, personal attacks and character flaws in the candidates as opposed to the range of issues that they're representing. And so I think what that leads to is people have much more gut reactions to candidates instead of sort of a balanced approach look at maybe their issues they agree with or not. People have intense feelings about each candidate, which might sway their ability to move forward after the election.
All right. Why don't we hear from Barry? Barry, you there in Bedford. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I have been a Bernie Sanders supporter for a long time, long before this election came up. And I've been following Bernie for many years. Obviously, I supported him against Clinton, and I was, you know, I was really hopeful that he'd win with 22 points in New Hampshire. I was hoping it would set a trend for the nation, but it didn't. And up until recently, I was angry about that. I was going to write him in. I couldn't decide whether I was going to vote for Jill Stein or write him in. But I decided in the past few days, watching the FBI and what they're doing, the extremist elements inside the FBI that are politicizing our process, it now makes it impossible for me to do anything other than vote for Hillary. I have to vote for her now because of what they did.
So even when Senator Sanders said, you know, back in, I think it was June, vote Hillary, you were saying no dice?
Well, Bernie supports her now. And, you know, I've been bucking that. I've been saying, no, I will not vote for her. I do not want to vote for her. I'll write you in. And I was going to oppose Bernie's wishes. And now I see, you know, that's...
So you think the fix is in at the FBI, basically? For Hillary? Against Hillary?
Not the FBI, per se, but there's a group of people within it. There's definitely a group of people within it. It's not just Comey. It's people leaking stuff, constantly leaking things, and they're outrageous things.
Barry, thank you. You know, certainly the FBI's involvement in the late stages of this race has, you know, it certainly turned things up a bit and has raised, you know, significant questions and drawn criticism from across the political spectrum. You know, the president has said that he believes, you know, Comey was in a tough spot, basically, but... you know, Dean, you're the political scientist here. Is there any thing you can liken this to? I mean, is there any precedent in American politics, modern American politics?
That's a good question. You know, I was talking to somebody a few days ago about the idea of the October surprise and how it almost feels sort of cheapened in this race because literally each week there's a new October surprise, sometimes, you know, on a daily basis. I guess all not surprises are equal. Some are going to have more power than others. But it was interesting, you know, Barry mentioned made a comment that I've been hearing increasingly from Democrats since the Comey announcement, that there is a group of very conservative agents within the FBI who are sort of pro-Trump and that they are leaking this stuff as a way to damage Hillary Clinton. Now, I'm hearing that from Democrats. I have no sort of independent way to confirm that, but that has now become part of that is sort of added to kind of the view of the FBI's action as politicized. I mean, there is something to the idea that Comey was in a tough spot, whether he releases the evidence or just says we have emails, we don't know what's in them. He was in a tough spot, but it's clearly become politicized.
All right. Coming up, more in the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, we're joined this morning by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Dan Barrick of NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. I want to read a couple emails we received. One is from Ray in Dalton. The last 2 days, we've received 14 pieces of expensive political ads. They immediately went into the trash. I didn't read them. Do the campaigns not realize that these documents are useless, that campaigns would gain more respect if they announced that instead of expensive mailings, the money would go to charity? Thank you, Ray. And I will say, having dumped out my recycling at the dump the other day, it was a sea of flyers. I mean, I was standing up to my ankles in flyers. And, you know, you've got a stack of flyers on your desk, Dan. Is there any indication that this year we're getting more than other years, or just simply the volume of the spending in the U.S. Senate race?
Well, the volume of the spending, I mean, I haven't, you're right, every campaign for some reason, I don't know why I do this, but once the mail starts coming, I stack it up in a pile and measure it and just compare it. But, you know, you mentioned the U.S. Senate race. I think the last figure, $130 million total candidate and outside spending, which has by far set a record for the state. But in terms of why they do, I mean, I agree with the emailer. There's a certain, I don't know a single voter who takes a piece of campaign mail out of their mailbox and says, let me look this over and inform myself. But it's just, you know, one of these kind of traditional, you know, so if you actually look at them, they're almost designed, I think, to just create an impression with, you know, unflattering portraits of candidates or glaring type. Dean would probably be able to speak more to the sort of neuroscience of campaign ads. Yeah. But they're one of these, you know, sort of essential.
There's one with a mushroom cloud over Manchester. Yeah.
Yes.
That was fairly arresting this time around.
It's funny that you mentioned that, Dan, because I do play a little bit of game with these, and I get tons of them as well. I look at them and try to guess pro, con, who are they for, who's sending it, just by looking at the imagery. You don't even need to read the text. And you can do a quick glance, and if it's a smiling Kelly Ayotte, then you know it's a pro Kelly Ayotte. If it's a sort of a black and white picture of her frowning, then you know it's negative. If it's got a mushroom cloud in combination with that, it's a pretty good tip-off. So, you know, I've said this for many years. I think a lot of this money at the end of the campaigns is just kind of wasted. It's just sort of people are just saturated. The information environment is so full. I know we, you know, campaigns like to, you know, the sort of media narrative, it looks at, you know, changes in the last couple of weeks, and it makes it seem like everybody is undecided, and that's just not the reality. These races are fairly, or this race, much like 2012, has been fairly stable over time, and there may be some late-breaking movement one way or the other, but that's what happens in a close race. You sometimes get the feeling that, you know, everything's up for grabs in the last few days, and that's really not the case.
And let's go back to the phones. John is on the line from Plymouth. Good morning, John. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Great to hear your show. It's just fantastic this time of year. I'm voting for Hillary Clinton, and the main reason is no one's everyone's just stopped talking about Donald Trump's foreign policy. That's what scares me the most. How he said in an interview a while back, I would leave on the table that he would use a nuclear weapon in Europe. What he has said about our NATO allies, about paying their share of going at it alone, not defending the Baltics in case. That's why Putin likes this man, because he'll go through Europe like a knife through butter.
All right, John.
You know, okay.
Thank you. So he raises an interesting question. I mean, foreign policy you know, hasn't been necessarily the focal part of this race. It often is in a presidential race. Ali, do you run into many voters who are talking foreign policy? I have to say I am running into relatively few.
You know, I think it's more in the context of what we spoke about earlier, these character issues. I think if it's anything that voters are talking about, it's who they feel more comfortable, you know, with nuclear codes or negotiating with foreign leaders. You know, I think I run into a lot of Democrats who would argue that they don't feel comfortable with Donald Trump, given some of the statements he's made that they view as being pro-Russia and pro-Putin. And I think at the same time, Republicans would say they wouldn't feel comfortable with Hillary Clinton at the head, given some of the things Dan mentioned about the Clinton Foundation and some of its work it's done with foreign countries and others. So I don't think it might not be a direct discussion of foreign policy, but I think voters are talking about it in the context of which candidate they feel more comfortable with and whether they trust one or the other.
And I want to move to another email. This one came from Deborah in Guilford. What does the panel think about many Republicans already talking about obstructing any Supreme Court appointees by President Clinton? And this issue is obviously germane in the U.S. Senate race between Governor Hassan and incumbent Republican Kelly Ayotte. We're going to turn to that race now. And, you know, for the record, Senator Ayotte said that her hold, she was obviously, you know, with the Republican majority in saying the nomination of Merrick Garland to fill the vacancy left by the death of Justice Scalia would not be considered in the Senate. She says, you know, that she'll, you know, the next president, she'll consider those nominees. There are some Senate Republicans who say no dice if Hillary gets elected. You know, Dan, this was an issue that was really a big one right at the start of the Senate race.
Yeah, and in some ways that position is a logical next step from the stance that Senate Republicans have held for almost the last year since Justice Scalia passed away and refusing to even hold hearings with Merrick Garland. And you're right about Ayotte sort of offering a different step there, but it's kind of quieted down a little bit. But, you know, for a while you had, you know, a bipartisan, especially people in the legal community, really talking about a breakdown in the system there, that, that a 4-4 court was doing quite a lot of damage. And in some ways, that's both, you've seen both sides in the presidential race use the kind of specter of a President Trump or President Clinton appointing lifetime members of the Supreme Court. But in terms of just the mechanics of it, you sort of heard less and less of that on the trail, it feels like.
But it is true that these confirmation battles have become kind of a central front in institutional conflict. And it's funny, I'm going to be talking about the Supreme Court in class today. And well, I've been teaching for many years my students about sort of the politics of the Supreme Court. And I've always said the kind of worst case scenario for any party is going to be if they lose a premier justice from their ideological worldview, and the presidency is controlled by the other party. And that's exactly what's happened with Scalia. And, you know, I think Republicans are really kind of willing to just sort of do whatever they need to do to see if they can get somebody that even kind of remotely in their mind fills the ideological void that has been left. And I've said all along, I think that this argument, and Kellyanne has made this repeatedly, that that we need to have voters weigh in before we move forward, that's just a bogus argument. That's not what it says in the Constitution. They can vote him down. If they didn't want Garland, they could vote him down. But this idea that we need another election, that's, it doesn't say in the Constitution if you're within 1 year of a general election, you must wait to move forward with a Supreme Court nominee. I thought it was bogus when Democrats made the argument a number of years ago, and it still is. But that's a separate issue from what is going to happen next year. You know,
well, as a way to galvanize potential partisan supporters. Absolutely. I mean, it was this. There's three branches of government.
And it's not only going to be Supreme Court, it's going to be U.S. Court of Appeals, district courts, entire slates of judges could potentially be blocked. It all depends on how Democrats do with the Senate. If they get the Senate back, that may change things a little bit, were Clinton to win.
Well, and getting the Senate back may hinge on this race in New Hampshire between Governor Hassan and Senator Ayotte. And, you know, as this race moves to its close, the big argument is between them is, you know, who's been the more bipartisan? Who is more capable of working with the other party? Why don't we take a listen to a clip from the WMUR debate earlier this week?
She has stood with her party, voting five times with Ted Cruz to shut the government down and
Governor,
on the Supreme Court blockade.
Take 30 seconds to respond, then we got to move forward, Senator.
These are the talking points from Governor Hassan, but my actions speak for themselves. She has not stepped away from Hillary Clinton on one thing. I've actually taken the action of saying that I'm not going to be voting for our nominee because I am concerned about the actions that he has talked about in tapes. And, you know, so that speaks for itself. And I've done that time and time again in the Senate. That's why I have one of the most bipartisan records.
All right. There it is in a nutshell. You know, questions of independence, the overhang of the top of the ticket, who's less scripted. We can go round and round on this. This has been, it's all right there. You know, tell us what you think. Join us 1-800-892-6477. You know, Allie, you know, this talking point argument is something that Kelly has really been stressing lately. You know, is there any indication that this is sinking in with people?
The bipartisanship argument?
Well, the bipartisanship and that, you know, Maggie Hassan is scripted. I mean, they can both point to bipartisan things, you know, and in some degrees they're both right. In some degrees, you know, they're exaggerating. They are politicians.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting one. I think that Kelly Ayotte, in terms of the bipartisanship argument and moving toward the middle, you know, she's made a big effort to do that to show that she can break from her party in an effort to kind of bring home that argument about Maggie Hassan. You know, she broke with her party on endorsing an EPA plan to cut carbon. You know, in one of the more high profile and controversial ones, her campaign was handing out condoms at UNH to bring attention to a bill that she had done to try to get over-the-counter birth control available.
That one didn't end terribly well, but it was certainly a novel approach.
Right. And I think that, you know, while she may be trying to push that argument, I've talked to some members of her base who I think are really frustrated with her, that she has been making those moves. But by the same token, you know, I don't think that the base is going to stray that much when we're talking about control of the Senate. So I think that might have been a smart political calculation for her.
I think having Trump at the top of the ticket has been a tremendous complication for her. We have to remember that she ran in 2010 the last time, which was the Tea Party rebellion. Very different context. I think that the reason why Ayotte has been able to keep this race competitive is that she's really running as Kelly rather than as U.S. Senator or Republican Senator Ayotte. She has shown a knack for retail politics. If you follow her on Twitter, she pops up everywhere. She's at the transfer station. She's at the local Applebee's. She's at the
Market
Basket. And I think the Hassan folks have done some of Hassan has done some of that as well. She's come to it a little bit later than Kelly Ayotte, but I think Kelly has shown that she's actually a pretty effective retail politician, which is not something I would have expected a few years ago.
Yeah. And that's a dynamic that's really crystallized, I think, the last month or so of the campaign. That's kind of it's been moving in this direction as the Ayotte-Trump relationship has grown increasingly awkward, and now it's finally broken, that Ayotte is essentially campaigning on her own. I mean, you look at her schedule, she, as you said, she keeps up a pretty breathless schedule of events and largely doing it by herself. I mean, she is campaigning, I think, with a couple other female U.S. senators this weekend. And that's, I guess, partly by choice, but partly because just the reality of the rest of the Republican ticket between Trump and Frank Ginta and Jim Lawrence.
Who's she going to run with if she asks Ginta
well,
to resign?
The other thing, though, is that I'm not aware of any public events, at least that have been promoted by the campaigns, with her and Chris Sununu appearing together. Whereas on the Democratic side, Maggie Hassan has had no end of opportunities to appear on stage with Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton. We saw just even this week in Plymouth where Senator Sanders was rallying the troops for Hillary Clinton and put in a plug for Hassan, saying if New Hampshire doesn't elect Maggie Hassan to the Senate, the U.S. Senate could well stay in Republican hands. That's the kind of this kind of embrace that the Democrats have had that Ayotte has not had the luxury of. And I think she's turning it into an advantage or at least a merit on her part in these final days.
I think that is a good point. And I do think that the Democrats culturally have been more inclined to do that. But, you know, fissures within the Republican Party. And I would also agree that I think that, you know, Ayotte has at least sort of spun this as, you know, another sign of how independent she wants people to believe she is. And on that point, let me get a call from Kevin. He's on the line in Concord. Good morning, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi. The one thing that bothers me most about Kelly Ayotte is that all expense paid by lobbyists, ski trip she took to Utah, and that's just a prime example of somebody that can and literally be paid for by lobbyists. And I have a real issue with that.
All right, Kevin. Thank you. And, you know, the question of corporate influence, the influence of money on this race is big. This is a you know, central thrust of Governor Hassan that, you know, Kelly Ayotte's voting record suggests that, you know, she is beholden to industry lobbyists. And it is true that Kelly Ayotte's voting record for the first 4 years she was in the Senate was a bit less bipartisan and, quote, independent than it has been more lately. That's not uncommon when one gets closer to facing voters that you sort of move to the center a bit, Dean. But what do you make of the argument that, you know, Ayotte is, you know, beholden to interests?
Yeah, you know, I think that certainly that's fair game to make that argument. It is true that, you know, one of the primary tasks you have as an elected member of Congress is to raise money, and it goes on, you know, every week of every year that you're in office, and a lot of members of Congress complain about it, that it's the worst part of the job, but it's something you do, you know, and so I think that's a fair debate to have about her record on that. You know, we've seen the kind of back and forth between them over whether or not to have this pledge to keep outside money in, and that just basically has never really materialized. They're still, you know, I've watched a couple of the debates now, and they still are arguing over, you know, who's really at fault there and who had the opportunity to kind of close the deal on keeping outside money out. But absolutely, you know, corporate influence in politics and the need to raise money, that's increasingly part of the job, given how expensive it is to run for re-election.
I mean, apart from the questions of sort of image and positioning and independence and the top of the ticket, you know, in terms of discrete policy matters, Allie, like what's rising to the top, if anything, here?
I think both women are jockeying to make their own issues rise to the top here, and I think each has tried to fend off the attacks. You know, we saw at the start of the race that Kelly Ayotte, who's really carved a name for herself as a foreign policy hawk, I think she was really hoping that the point of this race would be national security. And what we saw is that, you know, Governor Hassan really took a hardline approach on national security and kind of fended off a lot of those attacks. So when Kelly Ayotte was, you know, railing against President Obama's plan to close Guantanamo Bay, Maggie Hassan came out against it too, kind of making that attack moot. And so I think the biggest one on foreign policy now is that Kelly Ayotte opposes the Iran nuclear deal. Maggie Hassan, you know, says it's imperfect, but it's the best way to keep a prevent a nuclear Iran. I don't know how how much, you know, that is resonating with voters in the state. You know, and I think on some other issues, I think Governor Hassan has tried to make women's health a real issue in this race. You know, pointing to votes that Kelly Ayotte has taken to defund Planned Parenthood, which, you know, has been a big rallying cry among Democrats in New Hampshire. But, you know, I think Kelly Ayotte has tried to fend those off by, you know, as I mentioned before, handing out condoms, trying to show, you know, she's, you know, pro-contraception and reproductive rights. You know, she hardly mentions on the trail that she is anti-abortion, which is something, you know, she ran on in 2010.
And she's spoken at, you know, Susan B. Anthony's fundraisers, you know, has 100% rating from National Right to Life, which is one reason why the condom giveaway was interesting tactically, because obviously on an issue like abortion rights, you have organized, powerful interests on both sides of this issue. You know, neither were wild about the condoms at UNH. Planned Parenthood and abortion rights people would say, oh, it's, you know, proves she's hypocritical. And, you know, social conservatives who oppose abortion, while you can make a logical argument that condoms, you know, would make abortions less necessary, you know, they don't want to go there. So it was interesting.
I agree with Ali's list of issues. But, of course, the other big issue in this race is Donald Trump. You don't have to, you know, listen to Maggie Hassan at a debate or rally very long before they try and yoke Kelly to Donald Trump. So that specter remains even in these final days.
One thing that's interesting about this race, I mean, you're talking about two, you know, the two best known, I mean, Gene Sheen is well known as either, but I mean, arguably the two best known politicians in New Hampshire, both seen as talents in their party, both ambitious, both very much within the mainstream of their parties. You know, all this money being poured in due to the Senate majority being at stake. You know, but I've actually talked to plenty of voters who are genuinely conflicted about this race. You know, why do you think that is, Dean?
I think because, you know, they're both kind of viewed as sort of, certainly, you know, how they're being presented in this race is kind of sort of traditional New Hampshire politicians, you know, fairly centrist, maybe slightly right of center, slightly left of center, depending on which candidate. And they've, you know, they both for a long time have had good favorability, low 50s, high 40s. And so that generally makes for a you know, relatively kind of conflict-free, somewhat popular politician. It was interesting. I watched the WMUR debate on Wednesday night, and that first half hour was really sort of the kitchen sink of negative attacks based on tying each candidate to the top of the ticket. And then once they got past this sort of outpouring in the first half hour, then it kind of settled into more sort of an issue-focused debate in the second half.
Coming up, more Granite State headlines of a political nature. Get ready for the election on our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange at nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook or Twitter. We have Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Dan Barrick, NHPR, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Before the break, Dean mentioned the kitchen sink. Why don't we listen to some of that kitchen sink in terms of the barrage of advertising that's been in the Senate race? It has been staggering.
Ayotte claims she's independent, then goes to Washington and votes with the Koch brothers 90% of the time.
And Hassan won't even rule out bringing terrorist prisoners to the U.S.
New Hampshire women need to know that Kelly Ayotte opposes a woman's right to choose.
A former Exeter teacher committed sexual misconduct. The union leader said Maggie Hassan's husband covered it up.
Just more political calculation from Kelly. Trying to have it both ways on Donald Trump?
Maggie Hassan mismanaged the heroin crisis, and New Hampshire is paying the price.
All right, there you have it. That's just a taste of the negative ads we've had. Heroin, Trump, sex abuse at Exeter, Gitmo, a lot going on in those ads. And you know, let us know. Have those ads, do you blot them out? Are they informing your decision as you weigh your choices in this high-stakes race? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You know, we touched on the spending. You know, I saw a calculation based on, you know, predicted turnout that if you prorate the spending and you assume it's about $130 million by the time we're done, we're talking $170 per vote in New Hampshire, which is staggering.
The flip side of this is, I think it's that website 538 calculates what they call this voter power index, where the power of any of a voter in any individual state to sway both the presidential race and the U.S. Senate. And perhaps not surprisingly, perhaps it's a reflection of that, or the spending is a reflection of this, that New Hampshire has the highest voter power rate because of the attention from the presidential candidates, and also the fact that our Senate race is so tight and we only have 1.3 million people. So I guess that's something to be proud of.
Sure. And in another race in which voters have a lot of power, we're going to turn away from the Senate now, is the governor's race, the other statewide race on the ballot. And you know, this one is interesting. You know, we have two young candidates, not terribly well-known in terms of particulars. I believe 25% of people in a recent WBUR poll said they really don't know who Democratic nominee Colin Van Ostrand is. It's been about, you know, who's a business leader, who's a political operative. And, you know, why don't we just open this by taking a listen to a clip from the WMUR debate.
For record, there are 62 fewer jobs than the day Chris Sununu took over.
Again, this is a great example of Colin not having any business experience and background. He's taking a single data point that he doesn't understand and painting a broad political brush with it.
We are out of time.
We've had tremendous success at Waterville Valley.
I wish I didn't have a clock, but we got to do it.
All right. There you get a sense of the tone and the tenor of this debate. They were talking about jobs at Waterville Valley. And this race has been, in some measure, about, you know, who has the better business record, hasn't it, Dan?
Yeah, it has. I mean, they're both trying to run on that. Chris Sununu is the GM at the Waterville Valley Resort for the last 5 or 6 years. Van Ostrand has been, for the last 5 years, an executive at, especially marketing at Stonyfield Yogurt and Southern New Hampshire University. Both men point to that, but the candidates are also, you know, trying to poke holes in that. Sununu, for instance, raises the fact that Van Ostrand spent off and on the first decade of his career in New Hampshire as a political operative. Doesn't bring that up much on the campaign trail. Van Ostrand, in turn, will poke holes in the success at Waterville Valley, decline in visitors and market share that they've had. But I think you're right, and I think in some ways there's an analogy that has an Ayotte in terms of that the two men are very, very similar within their position in the state party. That, as you mentioned, they're both young. They're both pitching themselves as sort of business-friendly, moderates within their party. They both have spent the last few years at the executive council, so they have similar elected experience. And this campaign took a while to really engage after the primary. They both had to come through busy primaries. Sununu's was quite a bit tighter than Van Ostrand's. But I think between the presidential race and the Senate race, they had a fight for a lot of attention. But we've seen in these final debates and especially within the kind of press conferences that the partisans try and have on either side, a real sharpening and a real personalization of this campaign.
Well, one thing that's been interesting is that to the degree to which they're both running kind of, you know, under the banner of brands to some degree. I mean, you mentioned Van Ostrand, he has a Stonyfield yogurt van, in one ad, and the other ad, everyone's eating Stonyfield yogurt. He talks a lot about Southern New Hampshire University. On the Sununu front, you have the brand of the Sununu family, and that certainly gives Chris Sununu a name recognition edge. And then you have Waterville Valley, which is something that's very well known to the public here. What's gotten less attention are issues in this race to some degree. And, you know, why do you think that is? And Allie, what are the issues that you see as most telling in terms of dividing these fellows?
I think they have had quite a robust debate about some of the issues here in the governor's race. And I think the top issue, which I don't know that most voters would actually name as their number one issue that they're hoping the state deals with, but, you know, it has been rail. I think Colin Van Ostrand has really made the strongest case out of, you know, anyone running for governor we've seen recently to bring commuter rail up to Manchester. And he's saying it'll really, you know, jumpstart the New Hampshire economy by bringing in new workers and new businesses. And, you know, then we have Chris Sununu on the other side calling it a $300 million boondoggle is what he normally says in debates. And so they tend to have their fiercest exchanges over commuter rail. I don't know that that's something, for example, people in the North Country are very concerned about, or even on the seacoast, but that seems to come up the most. Another is women's health. They've both been on the executive council, so they tend to pick apart their votes there. And we've seen Chris Sununu, he voted for a contract to fund Planned Parenthood, then he voted against it, then he voted for it again. And Colin Van Ostern has used that to say that he's not consistent on this issue.
And Planned Parenthood is really kind of the springboard for Colin Van Ostern's reentry mm-hmm. into politics after working on campaigns and then going to business school. And he ran on the executive council, you know, based on the council's vote to defund a Planned Parenthood contract. And Planned Parenthood endorsed him. And, you know, it's really been a rallying cry for him and for Democrats broadly.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about this race, and it's a shame it's not getting more visibility than it is, and I think that's because it's a presidential election year. I think a midterm year, this would be a much more high-profile race. Yeah, it is interesting, as Ali mentioned, that, you know, these two fellows have been on the executive council together for 4 years, and I do think it's a little less helpful when they get into the weeds of who voted for what on a given motion on the executive council. They do fall into that occasionally. You know, certainly the rail issue has been a huge issue, and that's increasingly become a polarizing issue nationally between Republicans and Democrats. It's almost a sort of ideological litmus test whether you support rail or not. Also, there's been a lot of talk about the contract with Dartmouth-Hitchcock over the state hospital and providing psychiatrists and staff for the state hospital. So, you know, they know each other very well. They sort of know each other's, executive records on the council. I think it's, you know, that's made it interesting, but it's not getting the visibility that it probably should. You know, I think Sununu has got better name recognition. We could talk about how that might be a double-edged sword for him. Colin Van Ostern is very well known among Democrats, less so among kind of the general population of the state. To some extent, like all of the other races, probably even more so than the Senate race, they are kind of hostage to what happens at the top of the ticket with turnout here.
Why don't we go to the phones? Michael's on the line from Manchester. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, everybody. This is Michael. I listened to the representative that spoke a little while ago about one of the more prominent issues here in the race. And as a student over here in southern New Hampshire, and I have a lot of friends throughout the state, you know, throughout New England, of course, too. You know, what we really kind of wonder is what's being done about the opiate epidemic here in the state. Since 2014, it rose about 73% to my research here. Throughout the United States, about 135%. It's been on a steady increase since. And Maggie Hassan did state in February that it was the second leading cause of death here in the state.
Well, polls indicate, Michael, that opioids are the top concern among voters in polling from UNH. And, you know, this issue has come up in the governor's race, mostly in the context of whether or not to continue Medicaid expansion, which is something that Colin Van Ostern wants to make permanent. Chris Sununu wants to sort of exercise what he says the leverage the state might have over the federal government by not making it permanent, but by considering, you know, extending it and trying to tailor it more to New Hampshire's needs, you know, as he sees them. But, you know, voters say this is the number one concern. But, you know, in terms of policies beyond Medicaid expansion in this race, like, what are we hearing?
Well, I mean, I think that the Medicaid expansion and the opioid problem is a good example. I do think it's really important to note that each of these men would have a very different vision for the state. I mean, you talked about rail, and I think for Van Ostern, that's kind of it's an issue that's clearly near and dear to his heart, but it's also represents what I think he tries to project as a much more, as he would put it, future-oriented vision for the state. Other piece of that, he talked a lot about renewable energy, solar energy, and brings up votes on the executive council, as Dean said, kind of in the weeds, but, you know, that differentiate him from Sununu. He talks about things like full-day kindergarten, which is a relatively modest on its face proposal. But I think, again, it's meant to signal a broader, more 21st century family-friendly policies that will encourage younger folks to move and get in the state's workforce. For Sununu, it's very much, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a traditional New Hampshire Republican campaign, very focused on fiscal issues, business friendly. You know, one of his talking points is that in his first 100 days, he'll visit 100 businesses to recruit them to the state. very little emphasis on social issues. And almost kind of, I mean, you know, he's got the Old Man of the Mountain on his logo, which in some ways is emblematic of this.
I think sort of a restorationist argument, like we need to, I mean, sometimes he says it in the context of opioids, sometimes he says it in the context of business climate, that like this isn't the New Hampshire that was when I grew up here.
And a constant reference to his own experience as a business owner, to project himself as somebody who has a, is engaged in the flexible economy that's sort of at the heart of the larger state economy.
One thing that strikes me as quite traditional about Colin Van Ostern's message is that he talks about things like commuter rail and full-day kindergarten and making Medicaid expansion permanent. But, you know, on the tax front, he is very much within the pledge-taking mold of Gene Shaheen, John Lynch, Maggie Hassan. And, you know, I don't know if anyone's actually tallied up what the things he says he wants to spend on would add up to, but the only new source of revenue he talks about is 10 cents on the tobacco tax, Sally.
Yeah, and actually this came up in the debate. You know, at first he said he would pay for some of these things with efficiencies like cutting postage and other areas that the government might be overspending. But yeah, raising 10 cents on tobacco tax is one of the ways that he plans to raise revenue, and I think that would come out to about $11 million. Governor Hassan proposed double that last year, and it came out to about $22 million. And I think the cost to expand full-day kindergarten is about $13 million. So that would just cover that expansion.
Medicaid expansion would be potentially more expensive than that. That's the shortfall between the state and feds is now being picked up by hospitals and insurers. You know, Van Ostern says, like, we can have a discussion, and he certainly doesn't rule out using tax money, but obviously that would be something that would need to be negotiated. But he's been pretty inexplicit about how he'd do that. Why don't we go to the phone? Sarah wants to have something to say about the governor's race. Good morning, Sarah in Manchester. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have found the governor's race very, very boring to watch and follow.
Why do you find it boring?
Because it's just two middle-aged white men kind of debating stuff. They really just get into their records on the executive council.
You don't find them to be young and dynamic businessmen?
No, I do not. And maybe it's just because the other races are so exciting, but I just find both candidates to be pretty boring.
Are you going
to
vote in? Or who are you going to vote for?
I am going to vote for Colin Van Ostern, despite, I don't know, I don't think he's a very appealing character.
Okay.
But I'm going to vote for him.
All right. Sarah, thank you. He may be boring, but Colin Van Ostern is going to get Sarah's vote in Manchester. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You know, Sarah says she finds these fellows boring. I have to say, as a reporter, I'm looking forward to either winning because it's going to be interesting to see what happens. You know, it will be a generational shift in our politics in the state, and you'll get a new crew in the corner office. I mean, obviously, Van Ostern does pitch himself as being part of the continuum of Shaheen Lynch Hassan, and he can be a bit sort of animatronic in his aspect. And, you know, Chris Sununu is a bit more improvisational. But this race is tight. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that a lot of people I talked to on both sides of the aisle recently were kind of operating under the presumption that, you know, Van Ostern, you know, was sort of creeping potentially out of Sununu's reach. Fresh polls indicate that's not necessarily the case, Allie, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. And just going back to the caller's perception that this race being boring, I actually, covering the races, I find this one of the most interesting races, just because I think, you know, in the Senate race, they're talking about issues that are pretty standard. You know, they're the attacks and lines that we hear every election cycle, nothing really new. I think with these younger candidates, they're really focusing on issues that we don't hear a lot about in the state house, where, you know, the average age of the legislators hovers around 60. So I think, you know, hearing the focus on full day kindergarten, on renewable energy, that's not something that we normally hear in the halls of the state house. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how either of these men will be able to mesh with the House and Senate, who traditionally haven't spent a lot of time on these issues.
Well, and neither one of them are, I mean, they're sitting on the council and they've been around politics their whole lives. But, you know, it's not like Governor Hassan, who came from the Senate. It's not like, even like Governor Lynch, who came in at a time when the legislature wanted somebody they believed they could work with better than former Governor Craig Benson. And so it's going to be a different atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I think the generational change is a very important argument. I think Van Oster in his late 30s and Sununu is early 40s, and our governors have all been kind of mid-50s and on up. So it is going to feel different, but I'm like the rest of you folks who are, you know, given my sense of the state legislature, you can't help but wonder what will it be like to have either of these guys trying to move forward on these issues. And Josh, I love animatronic versus improvisational. I may have to borrow that.
Feel free, Dean. So, you know, we've kind of let things get away from us here. We haven't made it all the way down the ballot, but, you know, what are you going to be looking for between now and Tuesday in any of the races we haven't covered? I'll start with you, Allie.
I am interested to see what shakes out with the state Senate. You know, there's been a push among Democrats to try to regain control. They need to flip four seats, so I'll be watching that on Election Day.
Dan?
State Senate, same, but also the Executive Council. I mean, with Van Oster and Sununu, two sitting councilors running, there's been new attention there. There's a couple very interesting races, Dan Weeks versus David Wheeler down in the Nashua area. Sununu's old seat on the seacoast, that could have a big impact for policy.
Dean?
Democrats have gotten used to good margins at presidential years. It sounds like it may be a little tighter than usual. That's what I'm going to be looking to see.
All right, and I don't want to look, but I can't look away in terms of congressional district number one. Tuesday is just a few days away. Have a good weekend, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.